want to welcome everybody. We have music here every Tuesday, going back about 25 years. Anywhere from one to, it's been up to five sets, depending on how many people want to play. I thought it would be a change of pace to have somebody read or speak. So what I noticed is over the past, I don't know, 7 or 8 years, a lot of musicians that I'm friendly with have put out books on music. Everyone has their own way of explaining what they hear. If you look back there, there's a book section. There's about 7 books on music. Joe Morris, Jack Wright, John Zorn edits a whole series of those. Patrick Brennan, I forget who else, Elliot Sharp. And I learn a lot from reading these books about the person who wrote them, as well as the way they deal with experience of listening and or playing music. And I got a book a couple months ago from Jason Weiss called Listenings. And I keep it in my pack when I take the train in every day from New Jersey. And I read, it's about 90 short chapters, anywhere from 1 to 5 pages. And everyone talks about a different aspect of listening. And I didn't really think about how complex and how many different things are involved with the way we hear things. Jason is here. He's going to read from the book. There's copies available if you want to buy one. And this is Jason Weiss.
At some point a few years ago, I was at a house concert, and I don't know why it came into my head, but started thinking of, like, all the experiences of listening. And I guess originally the thought was relating to music. Only half, I don't know, usually I say half the texts in this book are deal with music, but maybe more than half, I don't know. Most of what I'll read, I'm going to read eight short texts, and most of these will be related to music in some way. And there's the only one really recurring type of text, there are 11 of them total, that I call concert going. And it was the sort of insane attempt to think about and reflect on roughly 50 years of going to concerts, or more than 50 years. And the more I tried to do it, the more impossible it seemed. But curiously, some of the earliest ones, when I was in my early teens, even though I didn't have much of it in memory, I could focus on certain things. As I got to later decades, there were so many concerts that it was more a blur, and so sometimes I focus on places I went, like certain clubs or certain atmospheres. Anyway, this is this first text is from that ongoing series, which is actually spaced out through the book. So this one is Concert Going 3, Woodstock and Beyond. Back in December, I had celebrated my bar mitzvah at an Orthodox synagogue in Asbury Park. So by August, I was ready for Woodstock. I saw the ads in Rolling Stone, and I managed to convince my brother to go. He was home from college, as well as my sister. She was on her way to college. He, in turn, invited a girl down the street, and my sister's boyfriend came too, the electric guitarist. Plus, my mother lent her car. The lengths one goes to listen, no? What all that meant, though, besides a full car and a crowded lean-to, was the others were going to be occupied, and I would mostly be on my own. No one seemed to register the slightest concern, and that was quite all right by me. How I found my way back each night very late through the vast labyrinth of people, who knows? And how our parents let us go like that, a wonder in itself. Plenty more of the experience that I don't remember than what I do. Somewhere in the cell memory, no doubt. The first night I stayed watching concerts until 1 a.m., and the second and third nights until 3 a.m. What did I do during set changes before the next band took the stage each time? Talked with people near me, watched the Peace and Love Circus. For 3 days, most of my waking hours were spent listening to live music, and I don't recall what we ate or did for food, or if we brought food and in what form. Also, no idea what I had on me in the way of money. Nor to what degree, if any, my siblings ever worried about what I got up to, How would they explain it if little brother, instigator of the adventure, got lost or went off with the wolves? But the fact is, I did not get into trouble, and I was not smoking cannabis yet or doing anything else. I would just pass the joint on to the next person. I came because there were a lot of great bands playing up on the main stage, and I aimed to go hear as many as I could. Being more on my own, I was able to engineer that. So I did not wander too far or get distracted by sideshows. Mostly, I threaded my way deep among the tight, irregular rows of people sitting on the ground and planted myself within a decent view of the stage. For hours and hours I stayed until nature called or some other good reason, like the rain pouring down, which was quite a nice sound in itself, magnified by its falling on so many fleeing bodies, all making their own hurried sounds. The rain falling in sheets everywhere over the summer fields. Funny I imagined the rain again in that setting. After 5 decades of going to concerts, I can say that the mystery of live music remains intact. Memory tiptoes around in the antechamber. Glimpses of a performance may linger, impressions of tone, but from the perspective of sound, what was produced in the moment, being there is once only. Normally, a recording doesn't quite bring that back, even if it's Country Joe at Woodstock doing his modified fish cheer. I do have one recording, though, that I made myself from the audience, which reveals a singular detail that few would recognize amid the general excitement of the music. Paris, 1981. The theater at the Musée d'Art Moderne, Lester Bowie's terrific avant-jazz gospel ensemble From the Root to the Source. There, in the midst of the concert, when it's really heating up, you hear a gravelly, resonant voice nearby calling out, "Yay, Lester!" That's my great friend Ali, right beside me, and you can still hear him like that today. But Woodstock also spoiled me in a way. To have had the opportunity at a young age like that to binge on so much popular music at such a moment in its history, did that somehow accelerate my curiosity as a listener so that just a few years later, I was pretty much not going to rock concerts at all anymore in favor of so much else? Okay. Now this one, fitting place, is called Record Hunting. What are we searching for so assiduously? To hunt, dig, excavate, unearth from the vaults. Recorded music is far more complicated than meets the eye. Visually, it's as if nothing, a wafer, a ribbon. But what is embedded there in that nothing can reach an astronomical value or promise the most arcane of illuminations upon listening, or is just one more record, like a billion others. We don't know, and because of that, we spread out through the record stores and flea markets and library sales, our fingers walking the stacks, ever on the trail of a find. How will we recognize it when we see one? The aim is not simply to add another item to the collection or to snag a few bargains, all very nice, but we're a little beyond that. We, the tribe of discerning listeners, must keep looking. There are always records we didn't know about that may or may not be worth having. No need to be a completist. The mental cataloging also has to be fed as much as the ears. Sometimes it's enough to just read the cover and imagine the rest. Still, I wonder what will jump out at me each time I step into the alternate universe in extreme sport known as the WFMU Record Fair, as I did the other day. What recording will suddenly land in my hands that says, "Do not let it go"? I dodged the vinyl completely, mountains and mazes of vinyl the past several years, though I may take a glance the next time. I don't care about the stamp collecting aspects, the rare pressings and alternate album covers. It's only the music that matters, and some old albums never made it to digital. Instead, I comb through the CD stacks, especially the many $3 bins, while a whole elaborate inner dialogue plays out with each title I linger over. Faint, sympathetic tones echo from across 5 decades of listening to recorded music as I whittle down the reasons for keeping all but a few of my selections. It's amusing enough to see what resonances are struck in the mind at the mere sight of a name or a cover, and like a keyboard full of Proust's Madeleines, an internal sampling reflex, my thoughts bounce around an entire lifetime and further. A couple of years ago at the record fair, deep in the $1 stacks, which I normally consider a waste of time, I chanced upon a CD by Kolinda, which turned out to be, as I'd suspected, the Hungarian folk group I heard on record all the way back in 1980. When I was living in that crumbly neighborhood in Lower Montparnasse on the Rue du Texel near Pernety. A neighbor on the ground floor played it for me and let me make a cassette copy, which I still have in my basement. Bernard committed suicide not long after I moved across town. I could still recall the tonalities of the group's sound, and so for $1 I had a later record of Kalinda some 3.5 decades after first hearing them. Clearly, when we listen to a recording, we are listening to so much more. Something else about the $3 bins at the record fair, a reminder how popular artists live on. I saw live recordings by The Doors and Jimi Hendrix that I'd never seen before, not that I've kept up. Probably released in the last decade or two, but nonetheless many years after their deaths. I resisted the urge to feel like I had to buy them. Even in the 60s, half a century ago, an awful lot was recorded, so we never know when a new record may yet come out of someone long gone. Indeed, we like to be surprised by such discoveries, as if to remind us that time may be circular or built on resonances as much as linear, and that we might still hope to hear from the lost. Whether in used record palaces like Amoeba in California or the WFMU Record Fair, I think that is what drives our perennial search. The thought, for me, of a previously unknown recording of Chris McGregor surfacing, or further back, Herbie Nichols sessions. Records that don't exist, that might have it at a moment unaccounted for, that suddenly materialize almost because we went looking for them. So, now here's one called Radio. Broadcast radio must have started as a proto-surrealist invention, an elaborate gag that got out of hand. Open a drawer or a door and out come voices, music, a comedy at your expense. A box of the disembodied, an invitation to not believe your eyes, a turn of the century reduced to the merest twisting of a knob. It's funny how a device made for mass enjoyment can feel so personal. For more than 50 years, I've been listening to radio. Especially in my teenage years and my 20s, I learned a lot there. I suppose I must have been alone most of the time I was listening. Isn't that when we are most receptive, even most impressionable, when we're alone, all the more so in our youth? Sent forth from some mysterious corner, the slight tickle of sound waves seeps into our wandering mind, emanations from a holy ghost yearning to seduce, or simply because the ghost as well is alone. When we are with others listening, it's just a broadcast in the background, pleasant enough, a shared experience that nobody has to think about much. But taking it in on our own, with no one to keep us from the temptation, the music or talk might well transport us. Such was the illusion of the radio voice that by the simple act of listening, it seemed almost as if that person were talking right to me. The radio itself, that box of wires and transistors, was just a receiver, of course, and I, in choosing the station, was the receiver of the receiver. So what was I doing during those moments? In the past decade and a half, I've only listened to the radio when driving the car. But as a kid, a student, a young dreamer in my room, how was the body occupied, or not, while the ears were thus engaged? I can almost hear Eric Bauersfeld again on KPFA reading Kenneth Patchen at the beginning of the 70s, or a couple years earlier, the velvety voice of Roscoe conjuring mystical gardens from Khalil Gibran on WNEW. Yet I cannot see any occupation but the listening. Maybe homework, reading magazines, early Rolling Stone, Brodigan era, talking on the phone, or who knows, maybe just sitting there listening, looking out the window at the trees possibly, even writing something. As if to wonder whether listening to radio was only ever a distraction, or did something linger, even sink in perhaps, some kind of spirit. Programming, voices, productions of endless sorts, voices talking to us, carrying us over to somewhere else. Oh yes, this one is called The Single Note, and for one thing, I think it only occurred to me as I was writing it, but two musicians in the, I only mentioned these two musicians and in the first paragraph, and you would not think of them anywhere, you know, mentioned together. I'll read it first, then I'll mention. The Single Note, from the one, the many. That's really the oldest story. Science, religion, music, all arise from that basic principle. Paul McCartney once said how he could hear a whole song in one chord and speculated that it might be possible to hear a whole song in one note, if you were listening hard enough. Steve Lacy talked about a similar idea, but rather the importance for a musician sometimes to dwell on that one note and really go into it, exploring that note for all it's worth. To seek the intimations of such a flowering from a single note, what powers of hearing or delirium does that require? Surely it would depend on what instrument produced the note and the character of the sound. Is it decays, overtones, the possible clash of harmonics, the pulse and wavering within that solid note materialized out of thin air? These shape the sense of direction divined from that sound, the likely avenues of development and convergence. And yet, it is still just one note, an egg, a rock, a prayer, a mystery to be settled either by its natural disintegration or the distinct personality of a dogged listener, gnawing at the bone of that sovereign note until it yields some clues. Before the singularity, then, stands a savvy or deranged or inspired listener. Said listener is likely to be a musician, but it could be a meloman like me, stumbling upon that well of the note. Long as they don't fall in, a tune might arise out of them too. As with a drone, a tonic, a modal anchor, we cannot take flight if we do not start from the ground. Clearly, all such flights carry a subjective impulse. The one note, absolute in itself, resonates a little differently in every listener. As we step inside the rim, we may project multiple branchings from that note and hear them spin about in a kind of folie. If a form emerges, if our brief bout of madness proves resilient, takes a life of its own, we may even slap a name on it to find our way back there. Or that single and sovereign note might simply fade before us, awash in its memory of the sounding. So there was a, I did a book on Steve Lacy, I used to live in Paris for a decade in the 80s, and so I knew him and all this. Anyway, so there's a small network of French Lacy fans, friends of his, etc., who I remain in touch with. And one of them, a guy named Guillaume Tarche, who I think is in his late 40s maybe, school teacher, lives in the provinces, studied with Lacy for a moment in the 90s, I think. He ended up putting a book together that basically he sort of credits to all of us, but it's his book, and it's called Steve Lacy Unfinished, unfinished in parentheses, and I think Bruce had a few, you had a few copies at one point, right?
I did.
And so what it is he invited, and I recommended to him a number of mostly Americans, and it's mostly musicians, but not entirely. So anyway, that piece, the one note, or the single note, is the last text in the book. So it's, I think, 70% in English, about 25 or 20% in French, and the rest of it in Italian, according to who was writing it. And it was, and also the idea was because Lacy could handle all three of those languages. But anyway, at one point when Guillaume was saying, you know, well, send me something, and suddenly I'm looking at this piece, and it's like, oh, okay. So it landed in the right place. Okay, this one is called Sounds Authentic. Which are more easily deceived, the ears or the eyes? No doubt we are eager to be fooled sometimes. The trompe-l'oeil painter and the sound effects artist find willing participants in the fun. But in music, listeners prove quite adept at letting their own illusions shape how they take in what they're hearing. Questions of authenticity do have their place, however unstable. Yet such questions may end up misleading in turn, posing traps of simplistic thinking. Can white people sing the blues? Do they have a right to? Don't be silly. But what about me? There I was, at 15 or 16, up on stage, singing that beautiful and haunting lament, Oh Death, after the great Appalachian banjo player, Doc Boggs. I loved that song, yet what did I know about death? No one close to me had died, nor had hardly anyone I ever met. I performed the song in public several times back then, and nobody told me I shouldn't sing it. Still, the image of teenage me, an upper-middle-class Berkeley lad, wailing away on that lament seems incongruous. I was not a morbid kid, nor remotely Appalachian. Even so, I thought I felt that song in my bones. Puzzling out what is or is not authentic in a performance, and our assumptions about what that means, seems most salient an issue in the presence of vernacular styles, roots music, when we behold someone from outside that culture playing in the music as if, with eyes closed, you wouldn't know. Though I never saw them play, many years ago I heard a tiny bit of a Japanese bluegrass band. How was it possible? Were they pure imitation? But they were kicking up the hay like the best of them. And never mind white blues musicians, how could a Frenchman, Bill Durham, get away with playing the blues in French. Yet why not? Maybe such phenomena are not so different from the folk revivalists of the 60s, many of whom had little or nothing of the musical culture they adopted in their own family backgrounds. Or the klezmer revival of the 70s and later. A good number of those musicians couldn't have been further from the original culture growing up in their American suburbs. Let alone to see clarinetist Don Byron playing that music in his early years, an African-American artist known later for his ambitious work in and out of the jazz tradition. Or more recently, the klezmer players in Puebla, Mexico, none of whom are Jewish. Or what about the contemporary Argentine freak folk band Diente de Madera playing American traditional songs like the cuckoo? Didn't any of these musicians get the memo? This was not their music. Shouldn't their listeners know?
Okay. Yes, this is a non-music one. A short one-page thing.
Winter, snowy terrain. I walk along roads and paths, careful not to slip on the ice. If I fell and hit my head, who would hear the dull thud, a muted and brief event? Like any blow to the body, louder from inside than out. So I tend to keep toward the side of the road where the snow is still crusted and the crunch underfoot, step after step, tells me that the treads on the soles of my shoes are gripping the ground and I will not fall. That is a sort of bluff, but which grants a certain security, at least while I remain alert for the sound. As I walk and gaze about through the trees, turning my head for a wider perspective, I soon forget to watch my steps, forget about the steady crunch of confirmation, and before long, my foot goes sliding. So quiet that sliding, the whisper of ice, ice unsuspected. But I catch myself and remember what I know, seek out the passing crunch of certainty. Step after step, my feet go biting into the ground, and the snow, crunching in response, says, I will hold you. Okay, now, two more. This one is called Whistling Fool, and I guess my whole life long I've been, you know, one of those people just whistles all the time, when I'm coming up the street, sometimes I come back home and my wife is there and she says, I heard you whistling down the block. And sometimes other neighbors will say stuff like that. And, you know, usually people are happy to notice it. Whistling Fool. The time signature remains the same. That has never changed. My footsteps. If there was a time before the habit took hold of me, as there probably was, I cannot recall what it was like, that emptiness. Or if not emptiness, that waiting. That invitation, that gathering into forward motion just below the wellsprings of consciousness, because I am a fool for whistling. Whenever it started, and surely long before, meandering through the confused whisper of the world, that whistling tripped forth from the cranial jukebox, and once let loose found perches near and far, in the most unsuspected corners, or else right in front of me, curious at my inattention until that moment. A friendly sound, untrained, not quite full-bodied and lacking a perfect tone. It doesn't care about the hearing or the airing or the faring. Obstacles sooner give it strength as it rises and floats, bouncing unbidden off hidden embankments or bending away to test intervals, chance ladders to climb and stepping off vanish. The truth is, I don't know where it goes until it gets there, nor what stirs it awake exactly. Maybe someone said a word or mentioned a cultural reference, maybe the shape of a thought or the rhythms of light, branches, passing surfaces, the unintended sequence of a noise, a horn, a crack in the sky, produce an opening, the glimpse of an opening, and I fall in. If I was given a formula to plot its course, some kind of plan or algorithm, I would not know how to use it, and the whistling would wend its way regardless, ever unpredictable. The melodies that unfold, I suppose, have to come from somewhere, or not. Someone's happy, I've been told, and yet I don't think happiness is especially the generator either. Every season and every mood provide their tones, their hints of a phrase or memory. Does the whistling anticipate my moves? Sometimes I'm certain that it does. Hey, let's try this, it says, and off we go. But even when a tune slips mysteriously into my thoughts and I carry it along in my whistling, no matter how carefully I trace it, before long memory stumbles and lands me on a different note, what might seem a wrong note, which then leads to new paths and possibilities, and I've lost the thread completely. But I can do that. Who else but me, since I'm the whistling fool? Besides, if it sounds like a concert, that's only accidental. I have no responsibilities to an audience, nor to mastering an instrument. Just pucker up my lips and blow. Can take it where I may, or let it take me. We'll get there together anyhow. Okay, so the last one is called Musicians. But who are these creatures, and what are they doing here? More to the point, how do they listen to each other? It is not like doing anything else. Playing music together is a practice in simultaneity, listening while one continues to play. In most genres, where the work is more or less written, that instant feedback loop helps keep everyone directed towards the music they were intending to make. But in improvised music, notably free improvised music, thriving more than ever despite its often announced demise over the past 50 years, this dynamic takes on a far more dramatic cast, for the music is unfolding in the moment, unknown to all concerned until it materializes before their ears. I am speaking especially of groups where there is no clear leader to follow, where the collective nature of the enterprise articulates an aesthetic born of the occasion, but also of works that, though they may be composed up to a certain point, revel in indeterminacy to provoke a different music with every performance, whether via graphic scores or other devices that dispense with fixed notation. In all of these, the musicians listen their way forward, sensing the thrust or momentum of the music they are part of, like a living organism, both carrying it along and being carried in turn. And it is by this listening from inside the moving present moment, alert to the gestures that they and their fellows are engaged in, that they may engineer a shift in direction toward unexpected openings discovered on the spot. If that were not enough of a challenge, the foremost task for musicians in the midst of all else is to listen to oneself. Just as we must listen to what we are saying in the very act of speaking, in order to remain coherent, we hope, musicians have to maintain awareness not only of the sounds they are putting forth right now, but also where they are going with it and where they've just been. Any repetition, for instance, should be conscious and purposeful, not the product of laziness or neglect. This all goes without saying, no doubt, and yet one must also leave room for the fruits of distraction, the felicitous accident, the better to capitalize on such gifts. In other words, consciousness need not be a restraint, nor inhibiting, but rather a kind of training, preparation for a certain porousness to recognize the unforeseen. From our seats, it may not seem the musicians are quite so absorbed, but there are worlds coming into existence that depend on their listening. Thank you.
Thanks, Jason. We're going to have a second set up in about 5-10 minutes. There was supposed to be a third group playing here tonight. They canceled because of the snow, but there'll still be a second set, so stick around, please.